From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Does that theme music sound familiar? It's the theme we used 10 years ago when Fresh Air became a daily national program. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate our 10th anniversary year by going back to our first year and playing memorable interviews from 1987. We'll hear about blonde bombshells and their bullet bras, cockroach movie stars, the true story behind a great movie theme, what a nice actor does to get himself worked up when he plays the heavy, what Matt Groening was thinking before he launched The Simpsons, and more. In the meantime, here's more of our original theme, composed and performed by Jackie Byard. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. U.S. stocks are lower now on Wall Street after opening sharply higher this morning in a positive response to today's recovery in the Hong Kong stock market. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 90 points in the first few minutes of trading as investors showed signs of relief that the Hong Kong market had recovered strongly. But U.S. shares later turned downward, with the Dow falling more than 50 points and triggering the trading collars, which restrict some forms of program trading. Investors were sobered by the sharp fall yesterday. It showed that even though the direct effects of the Asian turmoil on U.S. companies might be small, the U.S. market is priced so high that any bad news can send shares plummeting. Meanwhile, despite the recovery in Hong Kong, most other Asian stock markets were down. European markets were up initially, but gave back their gains later on. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.
The FBI has joined the investigation into yesterday's power outage in San Francisco. Pacific Gas and Electric says there's been no clear clue as to the cause of the blackout. No explosion, fire, or other problems have been found. But breakers and switches were discovered in positions they should not have been in. There were no signs of forced entry at the affected substation, and the company did not get any threats. Yesterday morning, a bank of transformers failed, darkening a five-mile stretch of city and blacking out 126,000 customers. U.S. Ambassador Bill Richardson begins a six-nation African tour today in Kinshasa. He's trying to convince Congolese President Laurent Kabila to allow a U.N. human rights mission to investigate alleged massacres of Rwandan refugees. Jennifer Glass reports.
Kabila promised in June that he and his government would help the UN Human Rights Investigation Team. But since the team arrived in Kinshasa in August, the government has prevented it from getting to work. Looking at the claims that Kabila's troops massacred tens of thousands of people as they captured the country in a civil war earlier this year. Richardson has a daunting task ahead of him. Kabila's government is largely distrustful of the UN and has appeared blind to threats that unless it cooperates with the UN investigation, may not receive hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to rebuild its crumbling infrastructure. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Glass in Kinshasa.
Former NBC sportscaster Marv Albert won't serve time in prison. A Virginia judge gave him a year's suspended sentence. Judge Benjamin Kendrick also told Albert that if he stayed out of trouble for a year, the charges will be dropped. Albert pleaded guilty to misdemeanor assault and battery last month by a woman with whom he had had a longtime affair. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 113 points at 7,734. Trading is extremely heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market has relinquished earlier gains and is trading lower. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The session began with a rebound following yesterday's tumultuous day as investors took encouragement from an overnight recovery in the Hong Kong stock market. The benchmark Hang Seng Index gained 6% after dropping more than 10% in the previous session. Even so, analysts say the weakening economies in the southeastern Pacific Rim have shifted investors' outlook. Expectations now are for slower growth in Asia, along with a drop in U.S. exports. In the commodities markets, gold has fallen to its lowest level in 3 months after a Swiss panel recommended the government leave its gold standard. The panel also recommended selling about half of Switzerland's gold reserves. I'm Doug Krisner.
Boeing says it had record sales in the third quarter of this year, but it's still reporting a loss of nearly $700 million. The aircraft maker says it's having trouble meeting heavy demand for its aircraft. Boeing's also been hindered by higher taxes and losses at the Douglas Products division. Boeing picked this up in August when it bought McDonnell Douglas. The world's largest maker of airplanes won record orders for 712 airliners last year and now is struggling to more than double its monthly production of jets. United Nations negotiators say a new global convention to protect humans and the environment from pesticides should be ready in 6 months. 99 countries have adopted a draft resolution at the UN's Food and Agriculture Association in Rome. The convention will set up an international watch list for dangerous substances. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMY.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year is our show's 10th anniversary year. On this archive edition, we'll listen back to some memorable moments from our first year, 1987. When we launched the show, we weren't yet well-known enough to get some of the big-name actors and directors. Our movie guests tended to be people on their way up or on their way down. And we landed some pretty interesting behind-the-scenes folks, like bug wrangler David Brody. Here's an excerpt of our 1987 interview.
Are you troubled by crawling insects? E.G. Marshall was.
I've got this bug problem. Once you get bugs, you never get rid of them. Breed in the crawl spaces, in the conduits, in the very core of the building itself.
In the film Creepshow, E.G. Marshall played a millionaire Howard Hughes-type hermit whose germ-free penthouse was mysteriously infested by cockroaches. These cockroaches were supplied and handled by entomologist David Brody. In Hollywood parlance, he's known as a bug wrangler. In the new film The Believers, he worked with tarantulas and centipedes. But his tour de force was directing more than 22,000 cockroaches for Creepshow. I asked David Brody how he rounded up all those bugs, including 2,000 giant roaches from Trinidad.
I made some calls to Washington, and I found out that if I was very careful, I can import the giant cave roach from Trinidad. They flew us to Trinidad, and you would sit on the floor of the cave, and the cave floor was covered in bat guano, bat droppings. Now, because the cave was dry, these droppings had the consistency of coffee beans. You would sit down on the floor with your legs crossed, and the ground, the coffee beans would undulate, because beneath them were the roaches. And we got about two-thirds of the roaches that we needed out of that. And then we went down to the lower cave, and that was a very wet cave, very disturbing cave, because it was narrow and constricting. And there was one point within that cave where you really had to wiggle through. And that's when the bats left that cave, they made a slight drop in their flight path, and that's where they defecated. So you had water dripping there. Now, coming out of the cave after collecting the roaches, my hand sort of slipped into that morass. And I wanted to amputate my hand at that point. It was very, very unpleasant.
The name that you're given when you work on a movie is Roach Wrangler or Tarantula Wrangler.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the word wrangler used?
That's
for your line
that's
of work?
A movie term. Horse wranglers, cow wranglers, and it sort of just trickled down. But I think it's a good term. I think it's exactly what we do.
How do you control roaches on a set? If they're actors, you tell them what their positions are, and you yell positions, and everything's all set. How do the roaches know where their positions are?
You build corrals for them, and you give the impression that they're doing things. And you can get them to move in directions by air current, by light. The very things that govern their lives, essentially, is how we use them. The scenes where they're coming up out of the sink were done with giant plastic syringes, and we just sort of pumped them in. My favorite scene in that movie was, of course, the bed scene, when he flips the covers off the bed. and the whole bed is just covered with a mass of undulating roaches. I thought that was just really terrific.
One of my concerns would be, if I were doing a movie like this, is what happens to the roaches after the shoot? You have 22,000 roaches running around a set. I mean, who'd want 22,000 roaches, not only in the set, but added to the city that it's being filmed in? Is there any way to ensure that you can gather them all up and control them when you're finished?
Well, the government regulations that I had with the permit stated that all the imported roaches had to be frozen and then burned, which is what we did. It was a wonderful job, by the way. It wasn't one that I was particularly happy to do. I don't like to kill animals, I really don't, but it was the only way. We just had too many of them to deal with.
Are there any ethical questions that you run into in your line of work, since you must get asked to do very unusual things with insects?
In my mind, I don't like to kill any insect unless I absolutely have to. And frequently, I did a shoot just with live bees recently, and I returned those bees to the wild. And I did The Believers, and there was a scene in The Believers where I had to pick up a live centipede and run a pin through it. And I had a very hard time deciding whether I would do it. And I finally did a little bit of research into the anatomy of the insect and the physiology of the insect. It's not an insect, I'm sorry, it's an arachnid. And I decided that I could do it and the animal would survive. And I did it. And as a matter of fact, we had to do that take twice. And the animal is still alive at the museum, in my office at the museum. So the research there paid off. But I don't think I would do it again. I really don't. It really disturbed me. I mean, the scene was dynamite in the movie. It was a very nice scene, but it really bothered me to do it.
What bothers you is the thought of torturing insects.
That's right. I don't like to do that at all.
Well, one of the most shocking moments in recent entertainment television was when the magicians Penn and Teller appeared on the David Letterman show, and Letterman said, "I want you to really surprise me." So Teller put his magician's hat on Letterman's desk, then lifted it up a little bit later to reveal hundreds of roaches, which immediately took over Letterman's desk. Letterman was absolutely horrified, or at least that's how
he sure was.
He appeared to be. Now, you were the wrangler that Penn and Teller used to get those roaches. When they called you up and asked you to surprise David Letterman live on television, what did you think of the idea?
Well, it was a matter of getting Penn and Teller to learn to handle the insects, and they did that pretty well. When it came to the final roundup, they just pitched in and helped. They helped me scoop them up, which says a lot for Penn and Teller. And we got them all back, except for one, which showed up the next night when Julia Child was doing some cooking, I understand. I thought that was rather amusing.
Bug wrangler David Brody, recorded in 1987. When I first started watching movies in the 1950s, women on screen seemed far better endowed than the mothers in my neighborhood. In 1987, I learned why when I interviewed an ex-blonde bombshell. Here's an excerpt of an interview from our first year as a national program. She was born Jane Olander in a small South Dakota town. When she was 15, she was discovered by Howard Hughes and was on her way to becoming a Hollywood starlet. When she landed a movie contract at Universal in 1953, the studio changed her name to Mamie Van Doren. They were hoping that she would be the next Marilyn Monroe. But unlike Marilyn, she became best known for movies about rock and roll and teen rebellion. By the mid-60s, roles for blonde bombshells like Mamie Van Doren had dried up, and she left Hollywood. She played dinner theaters and summer stock and put together a nightclub act. Now Mamie Van Doren has written a memoir about her wild Hollywood adventures on and off screen and in and out of bed. She told me about one of the props that enhanced her sexpot image, the pointed padded bra.
The wardrobe department at the studio had made them, and they had made them for women there that didn't have as large as breasts as mine, but they said that I was to wear one even though my breasts were large, and I followed the orders, and lo and behold, my God, dangerous weapons.
Did you have to be careful that you didn't walk into objects?
Well, especially two-legged men when men with pants on.
What were they made of, those bras, so that they'd keep their shape?
Well, the one that I had was it was lined with satin. It was very smooth, so it almost looked like skin. And what they did is they took a bridle button, and then they would sew it to make it look like a nipple. Like you walked around with hard nipples all the time.
Did the studio expect you to wear those padded bras in your off hours so that you could maintain the image?
One I had at the studio, and then they had another one for me to take home, if you know, to wear. So I guess they did. They expected me to keep that image.
But did you?
No, I didn't like wearing bras. I always just sort of, you know, I wore them when I went to the studio, but sometimes I didn't, and then the head office would call me in and tell me that I had to put my bra back on. I mean, the 60s was a feminist movement, and they burned their bras, and it was really the end of the platinum blonde era, but I welcomed it because I was really for that scene. I mean, I just didn't like what I had to do.
You were introduced to rock and roll by starring in rock and roll movies. Which are some of the rock and roll movies you were in?
I did Running Wild, and then I did Untamed Youth at Warner Brothers, which didn't get a seal of approval because it was too risque. I did High School Confidential, College Confidential, Girls Town. Well, I've done quite a few. Sex Kittens Go to College.
You even sang The Girl Who Invented Rock and Roll. Do you remember the lyrics? Could you do a chorus of it?
Now you've heard of instant coffee. You've heard of instant tea. See here, you guys, just feast your eyes on little old instant me. 'Cause I'm the girl. Oh, I'm the girl. I'm the girl who invented rock and roll.
That's great. It's just great. Well, High School Confidential is about...
marijuana and all that.
Yeah, it's a young hipster who's asked to infiltrate a high school and find out who's dealing dope. And it's very moralistic at the end about how this could happen in your school.
Oh, I think it's hilarious. I watch that occasionally and see myself falling drunk on the floor. Charlie, one thing I can't stand is a man who can't hold his liquor. You know, and then I collapse over this guy.
Well, I was thinking that probably while you were making this movie that was supposed to have this anti-drug moral at the end, that probably half the actors...
were stoned.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm sure. In fact, I know one of them was. You know, he got us through his lines. Oh, yeah, it was going on then. I mean, marijuana didn't just happen. That thing has been going around since God knows.
So much of your book is about your sexual adventures, including how you once tried to buy a gross of condoms because a lot of the men were really irresponsible about birth control, so you figured you'd better carry it yourself. And I couldn't help but think how different your life would have been had you been coming of age now.
We still had a couple of bad venereal diseases, and also we did not have legal abortions. And if you got pregnant, you know, you lent yourself to a butcher and, you know... And that was quite common in those days. So it was, you know, you had problems then, too. It wasn't all that easy. But I would not want to be out in the jungle today. I mean, I really feel for the people that are promiscuous, and they have to really be careful.
You know, you mentioned the risks that women have always taken when they engage in sex. You know, if for instance, if they don't want to get pregnant, there's always that risk of pregnancy. And when you were younger, abortion was illegal. Was that on your mind a lot? Did you always have this sense of risk during your period when you were having a lot of relationships?
Very much so. That was the first thing you thought of. Well, what time of the month is it? You know, you're very scared because... When you sign a contract at a studio, there's a clause in any act of God that any kind of scandal, I mean, you're automatically dropped. And I always remember when I was very young, I was growing up and I watched and looked at the newspapers when poor Ingrid Bergman was just she was deported from this country just because she was pregnant by another man. I mean, it was just, I mean, that scared me. I mean, I really got scared. And you grow up with these fears, and the only thing I could think of was just go out and buy my own condoms. And if they didn't have them, I had one for them. Well, I just happen to have one. If you want. You know, I mean, a lot of men were really taken aback to think that I was thinking like that. I mean, they got mad sometimes, you know. I'd say, well, it's your problem, you know.
Did you end up having to give sexual responsibility and birth control lectures to a lot of the men who you slept with?
No, if they were that dumb, I just didn't like them. I mean, I don't like dumb men. If they aren't aware of taking care of me as a woman at that time, as young as I was, I just didn't go to bed with them. I think men are the opposite. Men will marry dumb women, but I don't think smart women will marry dumb men.
Mamie Van Doren, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Mamie Van Doren, recorded in 1987. On this archive edition, we're listening back to interviews from our first year as a Daily National program. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I know that you're the kind of person who wouldn't let an anniversary go unacknowledged. You're wondering, what can I possibly do to help Fresh Air celebrate its 10th anniversary? Well, the good news is, you don't have to go shopping for a gift. All you need to do is pick up the phone and make a pledge. You'll never have to wonder if we like the gift or if we secretly try to return it. It's a gift that's guaranteed to be appreciated by lots of people. The entire Fresh Air staff, the entire staff of the station, and all of our listeners who know that Fresh Air can stay on the air only if you support it. Well, I think I'll go and get some of that anniversary cake.
There is no cake, Terry.
There's no cake? Well, there better be some pledges. As I mentioned earlier, in our first year, 1987, when we were struggling to establish a national reputation, we booked a lot of movie people who were on their way up, like Robert Townsend. 1987 was the year his film Hollywood Shuffle was released, which he wrote, directed, and starred in. This now classic comedy was the semi-autobiographical story of a young black actor who learns that the only parts available to him are absurd black stereotypes. Here's an audition scene from the film.
Anyway, after getting my degree from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I decided to come to Hollywood and do some movies.
Good. Why don't you start with the speech? That's very interesting.
Sure. Okay. Let me see. I ain't afraid of you. What is happening with your cool vines?
Thank you. Thank you.
You're the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. I have to be frank with you.
I could do it in iambic.
You be messing with the wrong dude, bro.
Thank you.
It
was
I got
nice.
It.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you like it?
Very much.
I ain't be got no weapon.
In 1987, Robert Townsend's memories of auditioning for stock roles as pimps and junkies were still fresh.
I didn't know how to speak up at that point because every actor in town was in there auditioning, and I said, wait, this is a terrible script. Maybe it's me. And then I started thinking about it, and I would go in and read a script, and I go, this is terrible. And then the next guy, this is the greatest pimp I've ever read, you know. And I think it had to do with, you know, I began back then to begin to look and see something was wrong.
What kind of roles were you auditioning for that you're talking about?
Stoolies on TV shows, you know, the guys that always have the information that the cops always talk to, Huggy Bear, Turkey Neck, you know, they always have those weird names. So those are the kind of parts I would audition for.
Are you convincing in that kind of role?
I'm a good actor. I could pull it off. Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a good actor. You know, I wouldn't mind doing a street character if I could play a lawyer next week and a doctor the week after that, or a detective like Sam Ace or something like that.
But the problem is there aren't many roles like that to play.
Right. They always write the stereotypical, you know, just jive street.
The character in your movie is directed to be blacker while he's playing a part or auditioning for a part. Were you ever directed to be more black?
Oh, yeah, because, see, the way I talk, when you're considered black, you're supposed to talk like, well, yeah, baby, you know, I'm doing this interview and things with you. So that's the way I should talk. That's considered black. If I was saying like, oh, this is national radio, baby, that's black. But the way I'm talking now, then they say, well, you don't sound black. I mean, you could, you know, if I was just tuning in, I would say, is this a black person? I don't give you the key words. And so a lot of times they ask you to be black, or because black is, you know, all the, you know, sitcoms of the 70s. And they say what? So that's considered black.
What are some of the movies you liked when you were growing up?
Wizard of Oz. My favorite film of all time is Here Comes Mr. Jordan with Robert Montgomery. That was one of my favorite films.
I love that film. That's the film about the boxer who's been reincarnated, basically, sent back
right.
down to Earth.
Yeah, Claude Rains, Robert Montgomery, and Warren Beatty did the updated version with Buck Henry and James Mason. It's like, Joe, listen, Joe, you're not Pendleton, Joe. You can't stay in this body, Joe. You know, that was one of my favorite films.
As a teenager, did you like any of the exploitation films like Shaft and Superfly?
I love those movies because that was the first time we saw the black man get the girl. You know, I remember seeing the scene in Superfly when he made love in the bathtub, and it was like, I can't believe this. Because other than that, black people had played butlers, and it's like, you want your luggage, Mr. Jenkins? And that was the only role we played. And so when you saw Shaft, and he had a gun, and he slapped people around, and he fought for right, you know, it was like, great. We had never seen it. Because normally, the black actor was the buddy to the star. He never, you know, like, he never was the man. You know, he never was in charge and said, I'm fighting for right. And that's what I'm going to do here. You guys are bad, you know. And Shaft was that way, and Superfly was that way. I just think that they made more pimp movies than they made movies about, you know, black people from the regular walks of life. I think that's what messed everything up. There were too many negative role models. I mean, if they would have had a pimp movie and then a movie about a doctor, then a movie about a lawyer, and a movie about a guy who was in love, everything would have been fine. But it was just, you know, 90 pimp movies versus one sounder. You know, that was what the deal was.
You started as a comic, I think, before you became an actor, and you do great impressions. Did you do impressions a lot as a kid? Did you do impressions of teachers or movie stars, family?
Yeah, I did a lot of impressions. I used to cheat the phone company. I used to call because I didn't have money. And when I was, you know, going to the basketball court, I would call the fellas, and that's how I used my talents back then. I'd get on the phone and, hello, operator, I'm sorry, I deposited a dime in the telephone. I can't reach this number. Yes, operator, my name is Dr. John Wilson. Yes, thank you for putting me through, operator. Thank you. Yo, Willie, how you doing, man? Yeah, meet me at the gym, 4:30. So I would do different voices and characters as a kid.
That's great. Did that work, by the way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you never knew who I was. I mean, because I'd get on the phone and I was like, hello, operator. My name's Paul Ogemeyer. I'm trying to reach, you know, Deborah Jenkins. That's right. You know, I just got it from Cheshire. I deposited a dime in the telephone. I can't get it back. So no one would never know who I was.
Why did you go into acting from being a comic?
Well, I wanted to be an actor first. I wanted to be a dramatic actor, and everybody would laugh at me. So I said, I should be a comedian.
Did they really laugh at you?
They really said I would do a dramatic scene, and people would laugh. And I was going, wait a minute, that was dramatic. That was drama. And people would go, no, you're funny, man. You're funny. No, that's funny. You know, and I said, let me be a comedian then.
Robert Townsend recorded in 1987 after the release of his movie Hollywood Shuffle. In the second half of our show, we'll hear more interviews from our first year as a Daily National program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Matt Groening, before he hit it big with The Simpsons. A great character actor prepares to get angry, the story behind two great Western themes, and a song to wish us happy anniversary. We continue our anniversary show featuring interviews from our first year. Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year marks our 10th anniversary as a daily national program. On this archive edition, we're listening back to some interviews from our first year. Some of our first guests, who were relatively unknown at the time, have gone on to become rich and famous, like Matt Groening. In 1987, his show The Simpsons didn't yet exist. Back then, he was best known for his syndicated cartoon strip, Life in Hell, which he called an amusing little trifle of a comic strip starring assorted, crudely drawn rabbits. In our 1987 interview, he described the cast of characters.
I only draw rabbits and a couple of humanoid figures. My main rabbit characters are Binky. He has very bulgy eyes, sort of a button nose, and extremely prominent teeth. He's based on a guy I went to college with. And then he has an illegitimate son named Bongo. And Binky's estranged girlfriend is named Sheba, who's basically Binky in drag. It's a part of a long tradition in cartooning to do female versions of the male characters just by giving them eyelashes and a bow on top of their heads. I'm thinking, of course, of Minnie Mouse and Daisy Duck. And then I have my two humanoid figures, Akbar and Jeff, who are either brothers or lovers, or perhaps both. And they wear fezes, and they have very big noses, and they have both eyes on the same side of their head. And they're based on a clumsy attempt at drawing Charlie Brown when I was a kid. My friends and I used to try to imitate the Peanut strip. And we could never get Charlie Brown to look anything like Charlie Brown. So it sort of mutated into Akbar and Jeff.
You make it sound like you don't draw very well.
Well, let me put it this way. No, I was the worst drawer of all my friends. But I stuck with it. Yeah, I'm slightly ashamed of my drawing. When I get together in a room full of cartoonists, I'm the one that is standing in the corner with my head hanging down.
When did you start thinking seriously of being a cartoonist?
Well, my father was a cartoonist before I was born. He drew those kinds of cartoons where prospectors are crawling across the desert, dying of thirst, and people are cast away on a desert island and the bottles float up and all those kinds of gags. So I think I got something from him. He also gave me a lot of marker pens. But like I said before, I never really could draw much of anything except rabbits. And so I had no idea that I would do this as a career. Fortunately, I went to a really wild college. And that was called the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And that had no grades, no required courses, no tests, no fraternities, no sororities, no football team, and no jobs upon graduation. But the best thing about it was that it allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do. And one of the things I did was work on the school paper. And that's where I met another cartoonist, Linda Berry. And she and I cartooned together. We stuck the cartoons in the paper, and that's basically how I got my start. She was my mentor, and tormentor, too.
Recently, you started doing animation for the Tracy Ullman Show. How does the animation that you're doing compare to the comics that you do, the cartoons that you do?
With the drawing, it's just me sitting alone at a desk, trying to keep the sweat from dripping off the end of my nose onto the page. And with an animated cartoon, I work with lots and lots of people, and it's definitely a collaborative effort.
How do the characters you've created for that compare to the rabbits that you do in your cartoons?
Well, they have the same bulgy eyes, and they have the same little button cute noses, and they have the same kind of very tragic overbite. But they don't have the big ears, except perhaps the mom, who has a giant bouffant hairdo, and she probably is concealing rabbit ears underneath. Perhaps in the last show I will reveal that she's actually a rabbit. It's a family called the Simpsons. Bart Simpson, Lisa Simpson, Maggie Simpson, and mom and dad. And they're sort of mutant 50s, father's knows best family in hell. That's sort of a running theme in my stuff.
Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, recorded in 1987. I've always liked interviewing character actors, maybe because they're not the glamour guys, they're easier to talk to. I remember enjoying my interview with Ned Beatty 10 years ago. It was 15 years after he made his film debut in Deliverance and several years before he became a TV regular on Homicide.
Your first film role was in the movie Deliverance. Did you have any reservations about making your screen debut in a role where the character is raped by a man?
No. It, as far as I can recall, never occurred to me. As a matter of fact, I was sort of, in a way, shocked by how people reacted to that. I was shocked, as a matter of fact, even when we filmed it, how difficult it was for the crew. There were people who didn't want to do the scene. At that point, my feeling about my work, my craft, my art, if you will, was the fact that I simply served the story. So it wasn't in my lexicon of thinking about acting whether or not I was going to be identified with this character and what happened to him.
You mentioned how surprised you were at the cameraman's horrified reaction to the rape scene in Deliverance. And do you think it's a combination of two things? One, the humiliation of rape, but two, a certain amount of homophobia?
I really think it had to do with how well we did the scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's a terribly egotistical answer. I think we did it well. I think it's a scene that would bother anyone. I don't know. It has anything to do with homophobia at all. I think it has to do with seeing any time we act out violence and we do it anywhere near how it might actually happen, that's frightening. Because what we've seen is we've seen a lot of violence in films and television over the years, which has no reality to it. When you do a scene that does have some reality to it, it can be very, very riveting.
Do you think that people in Hollywood talk about such a thing as a Ned Beatty type?
Oh, I suspect they do. You know, there's that old saw about, who's Ned Beatty, how's it go? Who's Ned Beatty? Get me Ned Beatty. Get me a Ned Beatty type. I suspect I'm at the get me a Ned Beatty type stage, yes.
So what do you think a Ned Beatty type is?
Oh, I don't know. I hope they're thinking in terms of an actor. I've always liked to think that one of the reasons I've been very fortunate is because I have been typecast as an actor rather than as a particular type of character. And I would hope that if they're looking for a Ned Beatty type, they're looking for someone who can do a few different turns, which I think all actors can do. I wish actors had, all of us had more of an opportunity to show different sides of what we can do as performers. But I would hope that's what I suspect a Ned Beatty type is a guy who's, gone past middle age and is overweight, I suspect.
Well, do things like age and weight affect a lot the kind of roles that you're offered? Do you ever feel limited by your physical presence?
No. Yes. I'd be silly to say no. Yes, you do feel that. I must admit, lately I felt so much more limited by the problems of storytelling.
Bad scripts, you mean?
Well, I didn't want to say it exactly.
Too diplomatic.
but no, I mean, I don't know if it's a matter of bad or good. I think we're having real storytelling problems in my business. When there's a lot of misgivings about the value systems and not knowing what it is we want to tell each other stories about, storytelling becomes very difficult.
Did you ever go to drama school?
No, I didn't. I don't know whether it would have done me a great deal of good. I wasn't a very good student ever of anything.
Do you think you have a different acting style from people who you've worked with who are graduates of the Yale School of Drama or who studied the method?
Well, I don't think so. Luckily enough, my university was the theater. And I got to work with actors who worked all kinds of different styles, with directors who worked in all sorts of different ways. I think I picked up on, through reading and through working, picked up on most of the ideas and thoughts about my trade in those years. What most actors do when they have some experience and have a chance to work around a bit is they pick what works for them. And you get to try out different techniques from time to time. I know sometimes I'll pull something out of the sack that maybe I haven't used in 20 years and dust it off and see if this will work. There's a little trick about music. Stanislavski talked about it, and some other acting teachers talked about it, that music can have such a strong and almost kinetic attachment to our emotional system. sometimes you can just think of a little phrase of a song, and it'll get a whole thing going inside you. And every once in a while, when I'm having trouble with, you know, getting the right feeling for a scene, I'll look around for that little piece of melody.
Is there a specific song you've used in certain roles?
There's one that always comes to my mind because I got so tickled when it worked for me. And I will tell you what it is, and you may take from it what you will. But I used to be able to become immediately and violently angry when I would hum a little ditty that we haven't heard so much in recent years called Ain't She Sweet.
Why would that make you angry?
I don't know why it works.
It's a little pop confection.
Yeah, I don't want to analyze it too deeply, but something about bum, 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 da 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 bum, bum. That just turns, I can get every hair on my head standing on end practically by humming that to myself.
I think that's really funny.
Yeah, it is.
I'll always think of you when I hear that song. Ned Beatty, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jerry.
This is Fresh Air. Hosting Fresh Air, I've had the chance to talk with people who made an impact on me when I was a kid, like Frankie Lane. I used to watch Rawhide on TV every Friday night, and I loved the way he sang that theme. I'm sure he didn't think of that as a high point of his career, but I felt compelled to talk about it anyways when I spoke with him in 1987. My guest is singer Frankie Lane, who's just re-recorded some of the Western themes he made famous, the themes from High Noon, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Rawhide. During the 50s and 60s, Lane had 21 gold records, but a lot of listeners still associate him with his anthems of the West. Eric Kunzel, director of the Cincinnati Pops, immediately thought of Frankie Lane for their recording called Roundup.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait, wait long. I do not know what fate. Okay, correct. Okay, correct. There the outlaw band make their final stand. Okay. Oh, my dearest, keep rolling, 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 though the streams are swollen. Keep them dogies rolling raw high through rain and wind and weather, a hell band for leather, wishing my gal was by my side. All the things I'm missing, good victuals, love and kissing, are waiting at the end of my ride. Hit 'em up, move 'em out, hit 'em up, raw hide. Cut 'em out, ride 'em in, cut 'em out, ride 'em in, raw hide.
When I spoke with Frankie Lane, I asked him how an Italian boy from Chicago wound up singing about gunfights and herding cattle.
In the beginning, I guess you might say that I was wondering what a city boy was doing singing country and western songs and Wild West themes. But apparently, I guess I was like any other kid who watched the cowboys and Indians movies. I was crazy about Westerns. And maybe it all harks back to that. I really don't know, but it all seemed to come naturally, and I didn't seem to have any trouble adjusting to that genre of music. And yet I never sounded exactly like a country singer in the sense of a Jim Reeves or any of those guys.
You know, I remember whenever I used to see you on the Ed Sullivan Show, I used to always hope that you'd sing Rawhide. And the times I saw you, you never did. So I guess I wonder if you've ever included that as part of your repertoire in performances.
Well, part of the deal on Rawhide entailed the proviso that I had to record the song first and that it had to be out at least 8 weeks prior to the TV show going on the air, which it was. And I was glad because by the time the TV show did debut, the record was a smash and it was fighting for the number one spot. In fact, the producers themselves told me later that the theme song, the popularity of the Rawhide record, kept the TV show on the air for about 4 months, and everybody laughs when I tell them that. And then I say the TV show caught on and kept me on the air for 7.5 years, so it turned out to be good for both of us.
Did you enjoy the opportunity of doing a send-up of all of your Western themes when Mel Brooks asked you to do Blazing Saddles, the theme from his Western spoof, Blazing Saddles?
I have to confess, Terry, that I was a complete dummy about that whole situation. I was working Vegas at the time, and I happened to do a Merv Griffin guest shot. Now, I get a call only about 20 minutes after the show went off the air from Mel Brooks, and I thought it was a gag. And I didn't know too much about Mel Brooks at that time. And he said, "I'm Mel Brooks, and I'm producing a picture called Blazing Saddles, and we have a theme song that we would like for you to do." And nobody told me that this picture was a comedy or a takeoff. I did it absolutely dead sure certain serious. And then I was stunned when I saw the preview of the movie, and I almost died when I realized that I was part of a big comedy setup. And I got ribbed about it an awful lot, but he said later, he says, "That's why we didn't tell you." He says, "We wanted you to do it dead serious."
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way.
Our interview with Frankie Lane was recorded in 1987, our first year as a Daily National program. When Fresh Air began its 10th anniversary year, we decided to celebrate by giving ourselves a gift. We asked a songwriter we love, Dave Frischberg, to write us an anniversary song. Here it is.
Fresh Air hooked up with NPR exactly 10 years ago. So today's the day to toss a bouquet to my favorite radio show. I must write a timely tribute, but what song form shall I choose? Why not just kick back and take a crack at some good old-fashioned 12-bar blues? So here's to you, Fresh Air of the Icing. Like a middle-aged, middle-class Jewish B.B. King. It was 1987 when Fresh Air went coast to coast. Now they're starting year 11 with my favorite talk show host. Yes, I'm a Fresh Air fanatic. Got to have my Terry Gross. She's so crafty and Socratic, no other host comes even close. She can talk to anybody, poet, scientist, or star. Conversation flows because she knows exactly who they are. That's why I'm a Fresh Air fanatic. Got to have my interviews. gross makes me ecstatic when I hear her murmur, "First the news." It's much cheaper than cocaine. And when Terry Gross can't make it, they got Marty Moss Cohen. So from a Fresh Air fanatic, happy anniversary number 10. And if you run out of folks to talk to, just play the first 10 years again.
Thank you, Dave Frischberg. That closes out our 10th anniversary archive segment. Excuse me while I brace myself for the next 10 years. This is Fresh Air. When we launched Fresh Air nationally, I didn't think we'd last 10 years. Really, we owe our longevity to you. We're on the air because you listen. Thank you for listening and for supporting us. You should know I'm not the kind of person who goes around hinting about what kind of gift I'd like. However, in this case, I'm going to make an exception and tell you just what I'd like to celebrate our 10th anniversary. I'd like you to call with a pledge. Thank you. Gattaca is a new sci-fi thriller that uses genetic engineering as its premise. The film stars Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman, and rising star Jude Law as Jerome Eugene Morrow. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Science fiction movies come in two kinds. There are empty-headed throwaways like Independence Day, which are mainly about thrills. And then there are the rare pictures like Blade Runner, which are governed by a genuine idea. They use the future to explore the present. The new movie Gattaca wants to be one of the latter. It's set at a time when the knowledge of genetics has grown so powerful that it defines the whole society, including social status. People with so-called superior genes get plum positions. Those without them become worker drones. Ethan Hawke stars as Vincent Freeman, who dreams of traveling to outer space. Unfortunately, his genetic profile predicts that he'll die young of a heart problem. His only hope for advancement is to assume the identity of someone with better genes. So he hooks up with wheelchair-bound Eugene Morrow, a self-destructive young man whose DNA is as rich as platinum. The two conspire to promote Vincent's career in the Gattaca Corporation, a painstaking ruse involving fake urine tests and sachets of blood beneath the fingertips. At first, things go swimmingly. Vincent slash Eugene becomes a favorite at Gattaca, which wants to send him to outer space. And he carries on an uneasy flirtation with a co-worker, played by Uma Thurman, who also has a heart defect. Then suddenly disaster strikes. There's a murder at Gattaca, and the cops find one of Vincent's own eyelashes, bearing its telltale DNA. Certain he's going to be exposed, Vincent meets with Eugene to tell him their charade is over.
They've got my picture plastered up all over the place. I can't turn around without seeing my own face. They'll recognize me.
They won't recognize you.
They'll recognize me.
I don't recognize you. They won't marry the eyelash to you. They won't believe that one of their elite could have suckered them all this time. No, 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 no. We change nothing. We do as we planned.
You're Jerome Morrow, navigator first class.
I'm not Jerome Morrow. I'm a murder suspect.
Gattaca is the debut feature by Andrew Niccol, a young writer-director who's loaded with talent. His premise here is ingenious. His style is utterly confident. But he seems to be making at least two different movies. The first is a great pulp riff on the consequences of genetic engineering. The movie's filled with clever bits, like Vincent carrying flakes of Eugene's skin to deposit in the crevices of his computer keyboard to fool the gene police. Such shenanigans should give this movie a bouncy pizzazz. After all, there's something intrinsically comic about a hero who's always carrying around somebody else's urine in case he's stopped by the cops. But Nickel has also been inspired by futuristic French art films like Alphaville, Fahrenheit 451, and La Jetée, which was the source for 12 Monkeys. And so he treats his pulpy plot with hushed reverence, over-designing every inch of the screen and playing the action glacially. The result is an icy, beautiful movie with a heart defect of its own. Although Gattaca's whole point is to celebrate the unpredictable glories of human spontaneity, every burnished frame shows Nicole's own desire for absolute control. Even the film stars Hawk and Thurman seem less like actors than decor. The only performer who shows any spark is the fine English actor Jude Law, whose Eugene is the sort of tortured misfit you find in Dostoevsky. He's shrewd and bitter, witty and self-hating. Only 24, Law has the charismatic soulfulness you see in Anthony Hopkins. When you look into Law's eyes, you see entire universes screaming to get free. He steals the movie while sitting motionless in a wheelchair, and you will almost certainly start wondering, why isn't this guy the star of the movie? For my part, I kept wishing that Eugene had been the hero. There's nothing very complicated about Vincent, after all. He's just an ordinary guy who wants to get ahead in a world where his genes count against him. In contrast, Eugene is a golden boy who's rejected the perks and responsibilities offered to people with superb DNA. He's the character who most eloquently displays what Gattaca's saying about the tyranny of genetic engineering. Tortured by expectations that he can't ever realize, Eugene shows that nothing is more crushing than trying to live up to the dream of human perfection.
John Powers as film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Alan Tu, with Monique Nazareth and Lauren Krenzel. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.